It's Monday night, America. And you're listening to WGN Nightside True Crime with your partners in crime, Dr. Kelly Richmond, Pope of DePaul University, and me, Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy of Governor's State University.
I'm not sure my name has ever been spoken like that before.
We're ending Columbus Day for our listeners here in the U.S. of A. Ending Thanksgiving.
Indigenous People Day. We don't.
Indigenous People Day. Day. All right. But it's Thanksgiving in Canada.
Yeah, we don't do that either.
Yeah, well, it's up in Canada. They're Thanksgiving today. So there you go. Anyway, hello, folks. I was trying to make it, sound a little nighttime because we're starting late today. Usually we start at 10 o'clock tonight. We're starting at 11 o'clock. So I thought a little deeper, Anyways, welcome, everyone. This is WGN Nightside True Crime coming at you from Chicago. And we're having a little technical difficulty in the room here, but we'll work it all out. But tonight we are talking about
whistleblowers.
And hang on a second. Okay, whistleblowers. And
but let me tell you how
Kelly,
met.
tell me about this.
Yeah, so a couple of months ago, I don't know what happened, but I got this message from Mary, and it was saying, it was like, hi, we have similar areas. Hey, maybe we should talk. And I said, hey, maybe we should talk. And so we were exchanging messages on LinkedIn, which is why social media can be important and helpful. And one day, I sort of dropped the ball. Like, you think you sent someone a message and you didn't. And so I was looking on LinkedIn last week, and I noticed that Mary had liked someone's comment. And I happened to send a message and say, hey, sorry for my delay, but would love to talk to you. Are you still interested? And she wrote back and said, yeah, sure. I'm going to be in D.C. on Thursday. And I said, well, hey, I'm in D.C. today. Any chance you could redirect your flight and come from D.C. to Chicago? Now, she lives in London.
Oh, wait a second. I've been on non-direct flights before, but D.C., Chicago, London, that's way non-direct.
Well, but this is when you are passionate about an area and you find somebody that's also passionate about an area, just sort of like how we came together, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mary was so willing to say, you know what, girl, I'm going to redirect my flight and I'm going to stop in to Chicago. Not only is she here in studio with us tonight.
That's right.
She spoke to my students tonight. So she's doing double duty. So she's already spoken for about 2 hours to my students. And so you can hear my voice. So I'm not in.
Well, she was doing the speaking. Well, Why did you lose your voice?
I was doing the yelling. Because
ah,
I'm like, I find that I talk really loud in class. Did you notice that?
I did notice that.
So, I got to get you a set of microphones.
I don't have a voice tonight. So so anyhow, Mary is this amazing attorney. So I'm the non-attorney in the studio tonight.
Uh-huh.
She's this amazing attorney that represents whistleblowers and some really household name whistleblowers right now. And I want
Mr. Clean is a household name.
No.
Oh, okay.
So I thought that she should come in studio and share her brain and her expertise. So Mary, welcome to True Crime. And I'm going to say my name in a normal way, which is Kelly Pope. My name's Kelly Pope.
Not Dr. Kelly Richmond.
No, please
Pope.
Stop. Please stop. Okay, please stop. So Mary, hi.
Hello, I am so delighted to be here. Thank you for having me. And yes, we do share a passion for financial frauds in particular. Ooh. There are many, many frauds. But when you get to speak to Professor Pope's graduate accounting students, we talk a lot about financial fraud.
Well, plus Kelly is like the diva of whistleblowers. I mean, she did the TED Talk on whistleblowers.
She did, and she has over a million views. And that's how I came to find her.
Let me correct both of you. It's like 1.5 million.
Sorry. Let's not understate.
I am not worthy.
But so, Mary, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I hail from Northern Maine originally.
Okay.
And I went to law school thinking I was going to change the world.
And you are, though. You are changing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I've been very fortunate. So I was very starry-eyed, and I clerked for a couple federal judges, and then I worked for 1 year at a big commercial civil defense firm. And then out of the blue, a headhunter calls me and says, there's this really niche area where you get to represent whistleblowers and help bring them to government enforcement agencies, kind of like paid confidential informants.
Ooh.
Would you be interested in that? And I thought,
heck, I'm interested in that. Give me that card. Yeah.
So I fell into it, and like all good things, and 22 years later, I have not looked back. It's been nothing but fun and very rewarding, and can be very high pressured representing people who put a lot on the line.
Put a lot on the line.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we do in my class, and Bill, I don't know if you like podcasts, because I know you make one. Mm-hmm. But
What's the name of that podcast I'm on?
It's Dupe of the Week.
Dupe of the Week, along with Dr. Kelly Pope.
So one of the assignments that I have my students listen to is the Dropout Podcast. That was published by ABC Studios and focuses on the Elizabeth Holmes Theranos debacle. And we love it. And one of the things that I think behind every fraud is a whistleblower. So behind every great fraud, there's a great whistleblower.
Hopefully.
Well, yeah. And so in that case, the whistleblower happened to be one of Mary's clients.
Whoa.
So Mary, can you tell us a little bit about that?
I would love to tell you a little bit about it. It is a great privilege to represent Tyler Schultz. So Tyler Schultz, for those of you who have not read the book Bad Blood or listened to the podcast, The Dropout, or seen Alex Gibney's HBO series, docuseries called The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley, Tyler is the grandson of George Schultz. George Schultz was on the board of Theranos, and he is a fascinating client because of having represented whistleblowers for over 20 years. He's the first whistleblower that I've encountered whose motivation was to protect his grandfather and his grandfather's reputation. He felt that his grandfather had come under the spell of Elizabeth Holmes and was not seeing clearly, and he wanted to get that information to him.
Okay, tell you what, let's take a break right now, and we'll be back with this fascinating story right after this.
In 2017, an even bigger whistleblower case made headlines, alleging a scheme which overbilled the government $1 billion. United Healthcare is the largest Medicare Advantage organization in America, operating in all 50 states. It now covers nearly 4.5 million seniors through MA plans. In 2016, Medicare paid United $56 billion. Now, it too has been accused of making patients look sicker than they really were by pumping up diagnosis codes. Those accusations are so serious, the Department of Justice joined the case.
There is an obligation when you are a health insurance plan to make sure that the codes you're submitting are accurate and truthful.
The allegations against United were made by Benjamin Paling, a former finance director at the company. Mary Inman is one of his attorneys.
As a corporate culture, there was a priority placed more on getting the additional revenue as opposed to submitting accurate codes.
In a federal false claims lawsuit, Paling described working in a unit which mined patient records. According to one United email, employees were urged to really go after the potential risk scoring with huge dollar opportunities. The executive who wrote it added, "Let's turn on the gas."
When you read this complaint, you can't help but come away with the feeling that this was part of the business model at United.
Yes. You can't just look for codes that enrich you and ignore codes that take money away from you.
Wow. Kelly, that clip, where was that from?
Well, it was from your PBS interview, but before...
Not mine, Mary Inman's.
Right, Mary, and we have Mary Inman in studio.
That's right.
And before the break, we were talking to you about the Theranos whistleblower, but the clip that we just heard was about another one of your clients, another whistleblower client. So we have this healthcare theme, right? Because Theranos was a healthcare tech type company, and so this Medicare Advantage is another healthcare. So there seems to be some common theme about you changing the world in healthcare and helping these whistleblowers. So give us some history on the clip that we just heard, and link it back to Tyler Schultz and this idea of helping people that have a voice, that people that need to hear their voices in these fraud schemes.
Sure. So the clip you heard was from a PBS program on WNYC that's called Ethics, Playing by the Rules, Ethics at Work. And it's interesting because this part of what the program aims to do is actually create case studies for business school students for talking about sort of like your dupe of the week. What are these? What went wrong? What's the postmortem? What can we learn from it? So they invited me and on with one of my clients. Mr. Paling was not able to come on, but another one of my clients came on, and it is exploring probably one of the biggest areas right now in terms of Medicare spend. The Medicare Advantage Part C plan, so that's basically managed care for Medicare, is one of the largest programs in terms of, I think, 1 in 3 seniors now belong to a Medicare managed care plan. So there's a lot of money in it.
Wow.
And so our client, Ben Paling, is currently... he launched, with our help, a case on behalf of the United States government alleging that United had basically improperly mined for codes that the patients did not have or could not be supported. Pretty serious charges. And the interesting part for me, of course, is that when you're the whistleblower and you're David versus Goliath, you're Ben Paling versus United Health Group, the largest health insurer in the United States, it is a daunting position to be in, but he has been vindicated in terms of the fact that the United States government has joined our case. So that's sort of the moment where you know, as a whistleblower and a whistleblower attorney, that you've succeeded, is that you've persuaded the government, who's the ultimate victim here, to join the case. So now we are in embroiled in litigation with big teams of lawyers on both sides, but it's us linking arms with the government against United Health Group.
So with going back to Tyler's story and Theranos and linking the Medicare Advantage program to Theranos, what commonality do you see in the motivations of the whistleblower clients that you work with?
There's definitely a primary motivation can be patient safety. These are things, remember, when you decide to blow the whistle, you are basically sidelining your career. There's so much at stake for you when you decide to do it. So it's not something you enter into lightly. And so I know both Tyler Schultz and Ben Paling, there's a sense of enormous amounts of dollars that should be directed towards healthcare were being improperly redirected. That's certainly the case in United Health Group. I think for Tyler Schultz, it's a similar scenario. I think he would tell you, and you see in the documentary, that when the test kits were being rolled out to Walgreens was really a moment of, now we have patients who are going to be getting test results that are not valid.
That are bogus.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but wait a second. I thought we had laws protecting whistleblowers. So how is it that their careers and lives are in jeopardy?
Well, I'm going to add to that. We also have laws that state speed limits, but we still have car crashes. So we still have recs. So even though we have these regulations that protect whistleblowers, do they really protect whistleblowers?
But I'm getting at the point is somebody might say, but wait, we have laws to protect whistleblowers.
Yeah.
Why don't they work?
But that's the rebuttal to that, because we have laws that protect speed limits, but we still have automobile accidents.
So you mean people don't obey the law?
People don't obey the law. They don't obey the speed limit. They don't obey the law.
But what are the protections that whistleblowers have under the law?
So it's a great question that you ask, and it depends, because in the United Kingdom, there is actually a global whistleblower protection statute that protects public and private whistleblowers, whether you're blowing the whistle against as a government employee or whether you're doing it privately. But what's so interesting here in the United States is we've been much more reactive in our protections. I would say we're much more siloed. So we are reactive. Out of the Enron scandal, we got Sarbanes-Oxley. Sarbanes-Oxley now gives retaliation protections to certain accounting and other professions, right? So, but out of the financial crisis, we now have the Dodd-Frank whistleblower reward programs, which have component of that is protecting whistleblowers. So we do it in a piecemeal fashion, not in a global fashion. So I feel like we have a long way to go. We could actually learn something from the United Kingdom model in that respect.
And even under what we have here, you have to fall right into the right way of doing things. We've seen cases, I was thinking Boeing when they were they're now based here in Chicago. They were based out in Seattle. You had somebody who wanted to be a whistleblower but went to the press, but that didn't cover them. They have to go through certain, you know, government actors and under, you know, you. So what if you do want to blow a whistle on somebody? What's the first thing you should do?
Depends on the program.
I knew you were going to say that. It depends. That's the best answer, right? It depends. It depends.
I was just telling my students today, you know, a business law thing, that for almost any legal question, the correct answer is it depends, you know.
So, but you are talking about a Supreme Court decision that relates to the SEC program. And you're right. After this decision, it's made clear that if you, in order to bring a successful retaliation case, you have to go first to the SEC, not internally. And that actually is contrary to what we think. I mean, we want to make sure that people go through the, it's preferable that they go through the internal channels first to give the company
Absolutely.
An opportunity to correct if that's possible.
Let's come back to this conversation, but let's take a break right now.
Here we all have a face that we hide away.
And we're back. WGN Nightside True Crime. Sorry, Vic Vaughn, I talked over you there for a moment. I'm just so excited about the guest we have in studio. This is Professor Fraud, Professor Bill Cressy of Governor State University, my partner in crime.
I'm going to say my name myself.
Go ahead, say your name.
I'm Kelly Pope. And
and who do we have in studio with
us,
Kelly?
I am so excited to have Mary Inman in studio today, in studio and in my DePaul University class this evening, sharing your insight and expertise and your passion about helping whistleblowers around the world. I'm just excited to talk to you. I was like a student in class tonight, so it was so great to have her.
If people could see you right now, you're like a kid in a candy store.
Oh my goodness, you know? It's just so great. She does such great work. So we were just talking during the news about some of the origins of where whistleblowing started, where it came from. So just briefly, can you tell us that?
There are lots of theories, but one is that we have Ralph Nader to thank for coining the term whistleblowing. And the idea was that on the production line, if something went wrong, you blew the whistle to stop the production.
Makes sense. Mm.
So that's one of the earlier, that's what they trace to be one of the earliest conceptions of the term whistleblower.
So if anybody is listening to our show tonight and they're thinking about being a whistleblower, what's the steps? How do you advise someone? If I think that I saw something, how would you talk to me? How would you advise me?
The first thing I would say...
Are you going to say it depends?
No, I would not.
Okay.
I would definitely advise you...
Oh, come on. She really wanted to, but you cut her off. Go ahead.
I think that one of the first things you need to do is have good counsel. And it's really interesting because it takes a lot of courage to even just screw up the courage to consider blowing the whistle. So I know that in our practice, we really place a premium on actually being available to answer the phone when they do. I think a lot of whistleblowers wait till the kids are in bed, wait till their spouse is, you know, asleep to even start to contemplate it.
I did a research study a couple years ago. I did a research paper study. We haven't published a paper yet. Hopefully that journal gets back to us soon. But it was about credibility in whistleblowing. And in your work, how credible or how does credibility play in someone listening to or believing the whistleblower claim?
So I think credibility, of course, is paramount.
Bill, you might not be able to whistleblow.
Well, very funny. Actually, both Kelly and I have served on boards of directors and audit committees, and very often a lot of firms, a lot of, you know, nonprofits, everything, have a fraud tip hotline where you can call in and anonymously, or if you want to leave your name, you can leave a tip. But the first question is this a true, you know, is this a valid tip, or is this somebody just venting against their boss or something like that? How do you measure that?
So, that's on the internal systems compliance question, right? And so that's something that hopefully can be independently corroborated. I think the challenges you're facing, that you're suggesting, are that if you're reporting anonymously, then it's hard sometimes to be able to ask the follow-up questions that you would like to ask to figure out what position they hold within the company. But hopefully they've given you enough of a scent of a trail to follow that you can figure out by other means whether it's credible and can be corroborated.
Now, thinking about this idea of credibility, one of the things that you mentioned in class tonight was distinguishing between the types of whistleblowers you can represent that can receive a reward. And you went through three things that we're trying to do with talking about whistleblowing: protecting them, empowering them, and rewarding them. And so, but there's different types of classifications of people that can fit into those categories. And whistleblowing is a term we're talking about a lot every day. Not because of my TED Talk, but because of the news.
Ah, yeah, I think I've heard that term in the news lately.
And so it seems like there could possibly be a renaissance of this term finally having a positive connotation. What do you think?
I think we're at a watershed moment. And for me, I think it's really important that we try and use this moment to normalize whistleblowing. I think the problem for whistleblowers is that they are either heralded as brave heroes or they're villains and traitors and snitches. And what we would love to see happen is that people embrace it as an everyday act. We all are faced with questions where we need to speak up and say something when we see something wrong. And it shouldn't be a career-defining moment to do that. You shouldn't be branded with a Scarlet W for doing that at work. So I feel like this is a perfect moment to take back the name whistleblower and have it be seen as an act that is a common act that we can all engage in.
But I know Kelly and I have had this conversation. It's really a cultural change because, you know, we tell children, you know, don't be a tattletale. And then as they get older, they learn, you know, snitches get stitches and end up in ditches and all this other stuff. But we have to turn it around and say, no, it's a, you know, you have a duty to come forward when you see something. You know, it's much like the honor system in the military academies, where if you see something, you're just as guilty if you don't come forward with that information.
Yeah, so many conflicting messages. Because as you were talking, I was thinking about something that we also say is mind your business, mind your own business. Mm-hmm. And so for the students that I teach, you're an accountant. The numbers are your business. So you can't just stay in your lane. Your lane is multiple lanes. So there's so many things that we raise people to believe. Snitches, traitor, snitch, mind your business. And then we throw them in this corporate environment and we say, tell it all. Tell me everything you saw. And there's going to be this law out here that's supposed to protect you. It will, sort of.
Kind of, yeah.
You know, so but, it's a, like you said, it's a cultural change.
And we both teach accountants or fledgling accountants. But the professional codes of responsibility also say you have to be confidential with your client information. So then you have to balance that. And if you're an attorney, well, there's client confidentiality. You can't come forward with information unless you know your client's going to go out and shoot someone that night. Okay. So we find ourselves all the time, a lot of people, in this
conflicted
situation of conflict. And I think one thing you just said, Mary, is you got to find yourself good counsel.
Because if you can afford it. And that's something else she talked about in class. A lot of people don't come forward because they feel like they can't afford it.
Right. And it's interesting because I think it's not very well known that all whistleblower attorneys like myself and my peers, we all represent our clients on a contingency fee or success fee basis, which means we only get paid a percentage of any recovery if the client is successful. So it helps. It's a sort of it prevents the barrier, gives access to justice for people. But I think a lot of people think that they have to pay an hourly rate up front, regardless of win, lose,
or draw. That's an important fact.
How do you find a whistleblower attorney? Is there a national organization of whistleblower attorneys?
Yeah, actually,
NOAA.
I'm going to Google it right now, and I'm going to see what happens. Okay, while you're answering.
How do you find them? Once you've screwed up the courage late at night, you type into the search engine, "Dear Google, whistleblower attorney." That's one way to do it.
Yeah, but is there a professional organization of whistleblower attorneys?
We have an organization, a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. called Taxpayers Against Fraud, and it is a grouping of all of the whistleblower attorneys in the United States. So yes, there's a directory you can call, Taxpayers Against Fraud.
And if you Google it, there's a lot of stuff that comes up if you just Googled whistleblower attorney.
Okay. Hopefully Mary's name shows up as well.
There.
Okay. Tell you what, we'll come back with this fascinating discussion after this. All right, we're back with WGN Nightside True Crime. I'm Professor Fraud, Professor Bill Cressy of Governor State University. And next to me, my partner in crime, I'll let her say her own name.
Because you say it weird. I'm Kelly Pope. And in studio, we have the wonderful Mary Inman.
Counsel to whistleblowers.
Actually, if you're going to call your name Professor Fraud, you know what her name is?
Whistleblower?
No, the Whistleblower Whisperer.
Ooh.
I don't have a name.
Do you have it trademarked?
I don't have it trademarked.
Okay, I'm running out right now to do it.
It's quite a compliment, though.
So let's walk through a case. I mean, I want to feel like the day in the life of the Whistleblower Whisperer, which is you, Mary. So what is a memorable case? And it could be memorable because of the issue. It could be memorable because of the clients you represented. Or it could be memorable because of the reward they received or didn't receive. So walk us through a case.
So two of my favorite clients are gentlemen who worked at Takata, which is the airbag manufacturing company. And they helped expose an enormous problem at Takata. So they just come to mind, they leap to mind because they were kind of an unusual pairing. One of the clients, Mark Lilly, was more well along in his career. He was the head of research and development at Takata. And the other whistleblower was on the production line. And so what's really interesting to me is Mr. Lilly, when he learned that Takata was going to start using ammonium nitrate as the source material to detonate the airbags, and ammonium nitrate is a very strong explosive that really is supposed to be used for open pit mining, not to be at close range with humans.
That's what the Oklahoma City bombers used.
Exactly. Exactly. And so he basically said, people will die. I will not stay at the company if this choice is made. And he left. And that left us with, well, but when you leave, you don't know what happened, right? So that doesn't give you a complete picture of the evidence. So his, a gentleman he had mentored, who was on the production line, stayed at the company, and he was not in a position to leave. He was someone who needed very much the job and to had mouths to feed. But he stayed on and saw that the airbags were exploding on the production line, that tests were being falsified.
Ooh.
So lives were at stake.
Lives were at stake.
So what was the next step?
So it was part of the next step was sort of pairing. First was pairing them together because they didn't come to me as a team. They came to me. One came first, Mr. Lilly, and we said that, you know, his information was helpful, but to really move the ball for the government, we needed that other piece.
So why,
there was some matchmaking going on.
So just to take a few steps back, why we should care? It's because everybody's car has an airbag in it, right? Well, depending on how old it is. But yeah. Most, well, that's not everybody, but most everybody's car may have an airbag in it.
And my Studebaker does not have one.
So we're all potentially at risk. This impacts all of us. So this is a safety issue. So our safety issue then turns into a profit maximization decision.
Yes. Yes, and what was interesting here is that Takata had a turning point in terms of they were doing just fine with the previous configuration. Those airbags were working well, but they wanted to capture more of the market. And so the problem was that they couldn't get enough of the source material under the previous iteration, so they decided to move to something new. And it was at that point when they wanted more of the market, and they decided that, you know, ammonium nitrate is plentiful when they cross the line.
Yeah.
I wonder what it was like. I wonder what the executives in that room, the ones that signed off on it, that thought this is the way to more profits, this is the way to expand the market. I wonder how they slept at night after the decision, but then after the deaths of people started happening.
So it's so interesting because, you know, no one will know, but, you know, that has to be a terrible place to be in, to have that blood on your hands, basically. What was interesting for me is that our client, Mr. Lilly, left the company and then was quiet. And so there was a couple year delay until he started to hear about the fatalities that he predicted would come. And that's when he decided to speak out. And he spoke out, not to me. He spoke out to the New York Times.
Oh.
And he was not aware, because this program is a very new program, the Whistleblower Reward Program under the Department of Transportation. So he did not know about it.
So nobody could accuse him that he's only making up these stories to try and get a reward. He wasn't even aware there could be a reward.
Exactly.
Wow.
So what happened to him?
So he ultimately gets connected with us, and there's a real sense of relief when you, I think what happens to whistleblowers is you're so isolated, and everyone else has sort of drank the Kool-Aid, or they understand it, that they feel very alone, and they think they're crazy.
You have to think that you're crazy when you're the only one trying to save lives, and everybody else is like, nope, we don't need to worry about this.
Exactly. So there's a real sense of relief when, and this is where the whistleblower whisper moniker comes in, is just that they don't teach you this in law school, but part of what you need to do is allow this person to feel heard and understood, and to give them that space, because they've been, I always say they're in extremis. They've been through a traumatic situation.
They've been in an abusive relationship just by themselves.
It's almost,
absolutely.
It's almost like gaslighting. It's like, no, you're the crazy one. We're, you know, you're, you know, it's not us, it's you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
Right.
So he got linked up with you, with your firm, and then what?
And then we said to him, it's not quite enough. We need to get the regulators' attention here. They know, because they read the New York Times, they know that you said no and that you wouldn't abide by it. But what happened? So that was when he basically said, but I have a colleague that I worked with who has kept in touch with me and has told me, and maybe if he could screw up the courage to speak, then we would have something.
Okay, now I'm going to build some tension here, because we're going to take a short break now, and then we'll come back to find out what happens at the end. So let's take a quick break right now. Okay, we're back and we're talking exploding airbags. And so, Mary, let's wrap this up. What happened in that case?
So ultimately, as a result of our client's information, the Department of Justice imposed $1 billion fine.
Whoa. A billion with a B.
Yes, which has actually put Takata into bankruptcy. But the really sobering part is that there were 26 fatalities, and a lot of those were preventable. So what's interesting is, on the brighter side, our clients have gone on 60 Minutes Australia, because we have seen that similar problems are happening in Australia, but they've been able to, at least in the sort of a public awareness campaign or consciousness raising event, they've been able to show and encourage people in Australia to bring their cars in to get as went by telling their story.
Were the whistleblowers able to reap or get any kind of reward?
So they've received it's sort of a complicated answer, but they've received a partial award, but there's an opportunity for more.
Well,
they're sharing a little over $1 million, so that's a start.
Out of a billion, you know, that's only 1/1000. You know? Yeah. See, I'm an accountant. See how quickly I did that. Yeah, wow.
It's a long road for whistleblowers.
Sure is.
And a lot of folks been getting recall notices. Bring your car in and get that old airbag taken out and put a new one in.
And they probably would have saved more money had they done it right the first time.
Exactly.
Wow. We have in studio Mary Inman, the whistleblower whisperer.
That's a tongue twister.
Yeah, I know, and it's late. So, well, we're coming to the end of the day, actually, Monday, Columbus Day here, in Indigenous Peoples Day, okay, and Thanksgiving to our friends up in Canada. So the best way to end a day, in my opinion, is with the news. So with the news, here's Vic Vaughn. And we're back. And it's now Tuesday morning. Good morning, everyone. And it's Tuesday morning, and this is WGN Nightside True Crime. And this is Professor Fraud, Professor Bill Cressy of Governor State University. And next to me is my partner in crime.
I'm Kelly Pope, with no voice tonight. So I may sound like Bill Cressy a little bit, but it's not. It's me. It's Kelly.
What? You sound nothing like me.
But after three classes, I'm done. Like, I have no voice. And I think I'm catching whatever's going around. So hopefully I won't give it to you guys. But you're great in studio fun. But it's going downhill from here. I might not even be able to talk tomorrow.
Let me ask Engineer Mike, do we have like an isolation studio with Kelly?
We'll have to see.
Okay, well, I'll check that out. Okay, and in our studio, Mary Inman.
All the way from London.
Wow. Well, she sounds nothing like, is it Londoner, Londonite?
A Londoner.
A Londoner.
Yeah, but she can.
A Londoner? Oh, you think I sound like a Londoner? Let's have a cup of tea.
Yeah, okay. Because you're originally from Maine.
I am originally
from Maine. Which is, you know,
this
close
is
enough.
New England, Nouveau England.
There you go. There you go.
But you know what? Mary asked the question I'm going to ask you, Bill.
Okay.
She asked me this question, and it was really a fun question. And it was like, it was this. What is the first whistleblower story that you remember that moved you, that made you say, huh? I'm glad that person told me. I'm glad that person reported that. What was that for you?
Wow. I think it goes back to the Federal Claims Act and the Civil War. No, I'm old. It's funny you say that. And it goes back to my time. I started out as a CPA, as an auditor. I'm going to tell a quick story here. And I was doing an audit at this corporation. I was only one there that day. When somebody comes into the room that we're working in and tells me, I have information about one of our purchasing agents been taking kickbacks. Huh? It's like, I'm thinking, oh, I've heard these things. but I'll only tell it to somebody higher up than you, because I was this, you know, fledgling young CPA. So I'm calling around trying to find somebody to come and finally find the partner in charge of this engagement. He was across town. He got in a cab, came across town to sit down and meet with this woman. Okay, I'll tell you. Our purchasing agent bought extra toner for the copying machine so that she could get a rival crock pot. Yeah, exactly. Crickets. The partner
is
looking.
This is your first story? Like, this is the first thing?
Yes, this is what moved me.
Daniel Ellsberg?
No. it was the rival crock pot story.
Oh, come on, Bill.
The partner's looking at me like, you had me come across town for this. I'm like, I didn't know. I was told it was a kickback scheme, you know, and it was a crock pot.
Okay, I'll tell you mine, Mary, because I was, I don't know, I guess I should have told him the question ahead of time. mine was the Space Shuttle Challenger situation and that whistleblower, Roger Bigelet, and no one listening to him. That was my first, when I really started researching and learning what happened, that there was somebody that we could have listened to that knew and no one listened to. That was like the first, like, whoa, like, these are some pretty brave people and have some really good information, and we should embrace them. That was my whistleblower moment.
Well, historically, not Daniel Ellsberg of Pentagon Papers fame, but probably Deep Throat of Watergate
All
fame.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
There we go.
That's
Is that better? It's better than the rival crock pot?
It's better than the crock pot, Bill. Come on.
It was a crock. Is that what you're telling me?
Crock pot. I don't know.
Yeah, crack pot, yeah. But
what about for you, Mary?
Oh, inspirational whistleblowers. My first whistleblower moment. That's so interesting.
Yes, who was your first whistleblower?
Yeah, it's sort of like your first date. Why?
It's after midnight, so we're talking. Hey, baby, who was your first whistleblower?
Your first kiss. Interesting, interesting.
Yeah, we'll let you toss that one in the crock pot and let it stew. How about that? All right.
Well, that story, though, Bill, come on.
It's true. It's
a crock pot?
It was a crock pot. It was the company that sold them toner for the copiers.
Don't repeat it again.
You guys have given me enough time to think of mine.
Okay.
Which is under the Federal False Claims Act. So the Federal False Claims Act is our initial whistleblower statute. It came in 1863. It is known as Lincoln's Law. And so I guess my whistleblower moment is to recognize that fraud against the government is that old. It's part of our blood, I think. And so the inspiring moment for that legislation was the fact that unscrupulous contractors were selling gunpowder cut with sawdust to the Union Army. So that's my whistleblower.
Thank you.
And broken down mules, too.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And that's a good one.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And to this day, now, I, a little personal story here, a program that I began in fraud examination, we actually were adopted by the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations, which is like the NCIS of the Air Force. And they'd come through my program because they wanted to train their people in finding fraud. Because, as was kind of pointed out in this New Yorker article that featured you, it's like the more we look for fraud, the more we find.
Yeah.
And I don't know, the DOD at one point was saying that, you know, for every new fraud examiner or fraud investigator they hired, they uncover like $1 million in fraud. So they kind of more than pay for themselves, because let me tell you, they're not paying them $1 million each, you know. But wherever you see big pots of money, whether it be, you know, pharmaceuticals, Medicare, the Department of Defense, heck, you know, a school board in some town, a town like, I don't know, Dixon, Illinois. you find the money, somebody's going to try and figure out a way to separate you from it. And that's where whistleblowers have to step forward.
Hey, speaking of Dixon, Illinois, guess what?
What?
All the Queen's Horses is coming on television November 7th on WTTW.
I'm going to tune
in. Wow. There you go.
Watch party.
Okay. And for those unfamiliar.
Oh, duh.
Yes, I'm going to say it, Kelly Pope. All the Queen's Horses is a documentary that was produced and directed by Kelly Pope, my partner in crime here. And it's about the situation that occurred how many years ago now in Dixon, Illinois?
Started in 2012.
Right. Which was Ronald Reagan's hometown, though he lived for a short time in Chicago as a child, but he grew up mostly in Dixon, yeah. Illinois. And the woman who was the controller slash treasurer of Dixon, Illinois, embezzled how much?
I was just letting you know what's coming on TV.
Okay. How much did she embezzle?
$53.7
million. $53.7
million
from a small town in
Illinois.
But
the linkage to this is the fact that the fraud was discovered by a whistleblower.
There you go.
And, you know, behind every good fraud is a great whistleblower.
And there's, again, tying that story.
Yeah.
Which was documented in All the Queen's Horses, which will be on Channel 11 WTTW in Chicago. November 7th. One of the things they talk about in that story is you come forward, especially you tell the government, okay, you tell the FBI or whatever federal agency, and it's like molasses in January because they seem to take their sweet time in investigating this. And
not in Dixon, though.
Not in Dixon?
No, because it was discovered in 2012. She was sentenced in 2013, so that was pretty quick. But what I want to ask you is, Kathy Swanson was the whistleblower that discovered the fraud in Dixon. If she knew you or you found her, could she have reported differently and received money?
So it's interesting because there are, because of the success of the False Claims Act used to just be, protected the federal government. So if there were private contractors who were cheating federal government agencies, then you had the right to become a whistleblower and expose it. Because it's been so successful, a bunch of states and localities have adopted their own False Claims Acts. So Chicago has a False Claims Act. New York has a False Claims Act. So if we could get Dixon to have their own False Claims Act, yes, she could have been.
There you go. Let's take a quick break now, and we'll be back with this questioning about whistleblowers. And it's Tuesday morning, WGN Nightside True Crime. And tonight, it's too bad it's not Wednesday morning. We could say it's Whistleblower Wednesday.
Maybe need to move.
It's Taco Tuesday.
It's Taco
Whistleblower
Tuesday.
Wednesday. That's funny.
Wednesday. But instead, it's True Crime with Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy, Governor State University, and
Kelly Pope.
And
with the raspy voice.
With the raspy voice. I kind of like it. But,
no, I killed my throat. So bad.
And next to you, your special guest, all the way from London.
All the way from London, Mary Inman.
Hello.
Live and in the studio.
The whistleblower whisperer.
The whistleblower whisperer. It's a tongue twister.
So, now, Mary, you spoke in Kelly's class tonight, where Kelly apparently yelling at her students and losing her voice.
Inspiring her students.
What do you tell? I mean, she's in the business school at DePaul, fledgling new business people, managers, accountants, whatever. What do you tell them about whistleblowing as they go into their careers, maybe somewhere down the line? They may have a situation where they may want to blow a whistle. How do you advise them? How do you prepare them?
Well, you prepare them by inviting guest speakers to come who scare the socks off of them by talking about what could happen.
And then they quickly change majors.
But it's not a major change, because this can be anybody, you know? You know, something you said tonight that was so powerful is how you opened up. And she really profiled the typical whistleblower. And I'd never heard anybody say it like you said. What did you tell them, Mary?
So I have the privilege of speaking to graduate business students in a lot of graduate ethics classes. And there's some amazing data. And so I say that you you young students sitting in the class right now are the ones who are most likely to be whistleblowers when you enter your first job or your first institution. And the reason for that is the empirical data shows that the more someone or the longer someone has been at a corporation, they become acclimatized to wrongdoing. And so it's precisely when you are the least, you're the lowest on the totem pole, you have the least amount of power, but you have fresh eyes. And it is in those circumstances where you're best able to see the wrongdoing for what it is and call it out. Mm-hmm. But you probably, because of the power differential, will feel, and the potential career ramifications, feel that you cannot.
One thing I tell my students is also, you know, you get out, you get your first big job, you're making real money, and this has been brought up, the idea you're putting a lot at risk is avoid the golden handcuffs. The idea that, you know, you go out and you get the big car with the big car payments and the condo or house with the big house payments, and you can't afford to walk away, and because of those monetary commitments. So avoid the golden handcuffs, because in a funny way, if there's a bad guy in the organization, they know that you can't walk away. So avoid the golden handcuffs. Keep your resume up to date on your home computer and stay in touch with headhunters. So if you need to, you know, pull the pin and get out of there, you can.
Well, you know, you think about how difficult that actually is, though, because as you start living your life, unless you're going to live in a group, in a house with 10 people and never have kids, pets, ever have to care for an elderly person, it's hard to do that, you know? It really is.
I didn't have a problem because I was a bachelor till I was 55, you know?
But, you know, it's hard if you think about that, you know?
And I think that's exactly what the whistleblower rewards and compensation are for. Because it's one thing to get a payment for if you were retaliated against by one employer. But what happens, and we've seen it time and time again, is that whistleblowers are blacklisted. It's the next employer and the next employer who decide, you know what? I don't think I want to hire a troublemaker or someone who... someone who speaks out and calls a spade a spade.
Well, so especially if the underlying case that they blew the whistle on hasn't been resolved yet.
Right.
So if you're that new employer, you're thinking, wait, I don't know if what's really going on there. Do I really want to risk hiring this person who might just be a troublemaker?
It's such a complicated topic, because if you think about it, you break rank. You know, you're not part of the team anymore. You're the one outspoken one. And we don't feel comfortable when someone breaks rank, you know, even if they need to. It really...
Yeah, totally agree. And so the most powerful research that's come out to date that I actually did not get to tell your class, but I'm excited to tell the Chicago listening public.
Exclusive.
Is the fact that there's a professor at George Washington University did research. He was given a huge pool of data from internal whistleblowing hotlines. And what he was able to show is that the more that a whistleblower hotline is used, the more that employees feel safe to speak up and call that line and report any problem, big or small, the fewer lawsuits that company has, and of the lawsuits that they do have, the settlements are smaller. So it is a theme that we love to say, which is that let's not malign whistleblowers. We won't say that whistleblowers are not only not bad, they're actually good for your bottom line.
You know,
they're good for business.
I have a TED Talk whistleblower story that sort of connects something that you brought up in the presentation tonight. And your first slide was Tricia Newbold.
Yeah.
And she was one of the White House whistleblowers.
That's right.
And we connected because she said that my TED Talk is what inspired her to blow the whistle. And I was so moved by that, because I would have never thought that it would have had that type of impact on someone. But you were, I don't know. It just made me smile.
And it should make you smile, because I think that's that when you're trying to screw up the courage, it's voices like yours on that TED Talk that give you the courage to say, this is why we do it.
Wow. I'm in the company of a couple of heroes here.
Sheroes.
Okay.
Correct that.
Sorry. I'm not into the politically correct terminology.
Clearly apparently. Not tonight.
Yeah,
not
apparently.
Tonight. It's not your night.
Blowing it all over the place. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's take this opportunity. My mistake here. Let's take this opportunity to take a break, and we'll be right back. It's WGN Nightside. True crime. It's Tuesday morning. We're talking whistleblowers. And we've got the whistleblower whisperer in studio all the way from London. We have Mary Inman and my partner in crime, Kelly Pope of DePaul University. And I'm Professor Fraud Bill Cressy of Governor State University. Okay, we're coming to the bottom of the hour. What? We were talking about, you know, what do you tell young people, you know, to prevent themselves, you know, from getting into trouble? One of the things you're talking about, you know, we don't like people if you're not part of the team. I kind of flip that around and I say, always be careful when somebody in your organization puts their arm around you or comes into your office and says, you know, we like you. You're a team player.
You tell them to be careful of that?
Yes. Because so often, and again, this is from an attorney who actually defended accountants and attorneys in malpractice cases, who were like the low person on the totem pole who got blamed for the whatever. And they would, the stories were always, well, they came in my office and told me that they were proud of me. I was part of the team and they were going to let me in on something.
But that's what we all strive to hear.
Not me. No, I'm a free spirit.
You don't. So you want to hear? You're a free spirit. You are a loner. You don't. You're aloof. No one knows what you're thinking. Like you don't want to hear. You don't want it to be described that way.
Well, that's probably why I was a bachelor until I was 55. Yeah. That's probably part of it. But yeah, I'm just saying, be cautious because that can be turned around and used against you. Okay. Well, tell you what, on that fun note, let's go to the news. And bringing the news is the lovely and talented Vic Vaughn. Yeah. Tuesday morning, WGN Nightside with True Crime. And this is Professor Fraud himself, Professor Bill Cressy of Governor State University. And as always, well, not as always, sometimes she's away like last week, but she's here this week. And that's my partner in crime, Dr. Kelly Pope of DePaul University. And joining us in studio right now is, well, I'm Professor Fraud. She is the whistleblower whisperer, Mary Inman. Say hello, Mary.
Hello.
Yes, and coming here all the way from London, England, not London, Ontario, the big London. Yeah.
A lot of people ask, why does a whistleblower lawyer like you find yourself in a city like London?
I was going to say, there was this wonderful article in the New Yorker back in January of this year, titled "The Personal Toll of Whistleblowing," talks about you a lot in there. And there's this one statement in here saying Inman recently moved to London, which is a top source of American whistleblower lawsuits outside the U.S. What are they doing over in London?
Little known fact. So it is really the product of the SEC whistleblower program.
Which one?
So the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Okay.
So after the financial crisis, under the Dodd-Frank legislation, they created an Office of the Whistleblower. And so it is allowing folks, you do not need to be an American, to make use of the American Whistleblower Reward Program. So if you work for the Royal Bank of Scotland, seems like a British institution, where's the American connection?
RBS.
They are traded on the American stock exchanges, which provides sufficient nexus and jurisdiction for the SEC.
Wow.
So if they're engaged in accounting fraud, then a British person at RBS can come to the SEC in Washington.
I tell you, it really says something about the long arm of American law, because recently a Swedish telecom company paid a huge fine because of violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, the FCPA. PA. Thank you. Got confused in the initials. For bribing government officials in like Djibouti. There were a bunch of other countries, but I just like
that
saying Djibouti.
Uzbekistan too.
Yes. Okay. But Djibouti's, you know, it's easier to say. But it's like, well, where does America get off fining a Swedish company for bribing government officials in Djibouti? And it's because their stock is actually traded on NASDAQ. And for opening yourself up to our markets, our securities markets, you open yourself up to following our laws, including the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. Now, I'm going to throw over to my partner in crime, Kelly Pope, because, as I say, Kelly, you brought Mary Inman, the whistleblower whistleblower whisperer into studio, but because you attract these people, you just brought somebody else into our studio.
So this is someone we've talked to before. This is Deborah, and Deborah's an outstanding filmmaker.
Say hello, Deborah.
Hello.
And Deborah's film is part of the Chicago International Film Festival.
Ooh.
Correct. And Deborah, I'm excited. So first of all, she had a New York Times op doc that just was an amazing story that's very related to what we're talking about tonight.
Okay, a couple of questions. Deborah, what's your last name?
Tolchinsky.
Which is why I just said Deborah.
Okay, all right.
There's a reason behind all of my madness.
Okay, and you also said a New York Times
op docs.
Opinion doc.
I'll let her.
We spoke a few weeks ago.
Yes, I know. So what is so what's up doc?
That's not what she said.
Opinion doc.
Tell us about it and tell us where you are at the film. I'm so excited for you.
So I was on the show a few weeks ago, I think. I don't know the date. But I have been working on a feature film since 2015. And it's looking at the way memory and belief become contaminated in the process of investigation. I'm following several stories as well as police in Arizona who are instituting new protocols that will lessen these type of mistakes. And as I've been making the feature, I've carved out a portion of that material that will eventually be folded into the feature, but into a short 13-minute piece that the New York Times released on their OpDocs channel, which you can view on the New York Times. But it will also be in the Chicago International Film Festival, and it concerns Penny Bierenstein, who is an eyewitness, and it's her story. I don't want to give it all away.
Sure. But so what we're talking about tonight are, we've been talking about the topic of whistleblowers, and Mary, who's here in studio with us, is a lawyer that represents whistleblowers. So I thought the combination of her expertise and yours would be an interesting conversation. So when can we see your film? Tell us. Mary doesn't know anything about your film, so she's mesmerized.
Please come see it. It is going to be showing October 17th at 6 p.m. at the Chicago International Film Festival. It'll be showing October 21st at 3 p.m. and October 26th at 12 p.m. And as you know, I'm in development with Kartemkin Films, probably moving into co-production soon. Yay.
Good for you.
You can also get more information about the film at True Memories and Other Falsehoods.com, which is the name of the feature, not the .com, but True Memories and Other Falsehoods.
And of course, you can get information on the entire Chicago International Film Festival at chicagofilmfestival.com.
Mary has a question. She has a question. Look at her.
I do have a question, which is interesting on your memory point, because often for us, whistleblowers within an organization have different vantage points. So if you're in the C-suite versus if you're sort of at a lower level, that we find the most powerful combination of whistleblowers is multiple whistleblowers providing the multiple pieces to the puzzle. So I wonder if that sort of collective vantage point helps get over a little bit of the memory problem is that if you've got
I don't see it as a memory problem. I see it as our problem with thinking that our memories are accurate. Mm. And when you said that, I was thinking about the fact that we all have multiple vantage points within our own mind, and it changes as time progresses. In fact, memory is not stable. It is not constant. There is lots of scientific data on that. It can be contaminated. It is contaminated all the time. Things are introduced. It doesn't mean that none of it's accurate. It doesn't mean that it's all just in, complete mush. But
can I use that with my husband and tell him
complete mush?
Yeah, that his memory's not accurate and that it always is ever changing and things can enter it and contaminate it. That sounds like perfect. Stop. Can send me that study.
There's lots of studies.
Well, plus, I think some of your film and other work go into the idea of very often police practices in trying to solve a crime, trying to close a case, will suggest to a witness things, and that is what can contaminate the memory of the witness.
That is one of the things that can contaminate. Absolutely. Your memory can be contaminated, especially if some of the information is accurate, and then you introduce other things.
Right.
And the more time that goes by, and if you believe and trust the person who is giving you that information.
Okay. We want to come back to this incredible conversation, but sorry, we've got to pay the bills, so let's take a quick break. Okay, and we're back. Wow. This studio is getting crowded. This is WGN Nightside.
And you're the only
crime
man, so if you're outnumbered.
Yeah, I'm here with the ladies. Yeah.
Nope, excuse me, the Shiros.
The Shiros are here tonight, yes. And the latest Shiro that walked into our studio is...
I am Deborah Tolchinsky, and I'm an associate professor at Northwestern University.
I've heard of that place.
Yep.
Yes, and you are showing a film at the Chicago International Film Festival called?
Contaminated Memories.
And you can get more information on that at the ChicagoFilmFestival.com website or?
On my website, True Memories and Other Falsehoods, which is the name of the feature, .com.
Okay, my partner in crime, Dr. Kelly Pope, is here, and our other in-studio guest, all the way from London, England, Mary Inman. And Mary, you had a question for our newest guest?
I did, and I'm very interested. I think this issue with contaminated memory has come up in the Me Too movement. And I wanted to get your sense of a new product that's called the Callisto Project. And it was raised as to address the first mover problem, which is that it sometimes, because of the power differential, takes a long time to get someone to screw up the courage to confront their accuser, their harasser. And so what this product seeks to do is timestamp it. If you're not in a position yet to screw up the courage to do so, there will be a database, a vault, in which you put and contemporaneously date stamp as your memories are fresh that recollection, so that if years later other people line up behind you and say, this happened to me too as well, and then you decide collectively to come forward, you've preserved a contemporaneous record.
Well, this is the first I've heard of it. It's fascinating. It's a great idea. One thing that they have shown is the time between a crime and the interrogation is key. And so that would back that up, and it's a good solution.
Yeah,
at least something that could help.
It's interesting because it came out of the movie The Hunting Grounds, mm-hmm. As a way to deal with rape on campus and allowing people to come forward. And there are 18 universities that use it now. I don't know if Northwestern is one of them.
I don't either, but now I'm going to look.
Well, we'll know by the next Monday.
it's funny because, and kind of tying it back to our earlier conversations, in dealing with my students, I often tell them that if they find themselves in a a situation where they want to blow the whistle, and let's say the boss comes in and tells them about some scheme that's going on that they, you know, we're going to bring in. I say, what you should do is, as soon as the boss told you all this stuff, and since in Illinois you can't tape record them without their consent, as soon as they leave, write down everything they said with direct quotes if you can, and then seal it up, put it in an envelope, walk down to the post office, mail it to your home by registered mail, not certified mail, because registered mail, they date stamp the seal of the envelope. And then when you get the envelope in the mail, do not open it until you need to. And only when you give it to your lawyer, who then in front of witnesses can open it, because then it's contemporaneously recorded recollection, and it has some probative value that can be used in court.
Okay, so this is me being Kelly. The issue is, schemes don't often sound like schemes. So that's the problem is when you're earlier in your career and you're exposed to a meeting, it doesn't always sound like a scheme. Like, it might just sound like, this is what we do. This is how business is done. We've been doing it this way. And it may, your internal alarms may not go off. And so that's what makes it tough, because no one says, hey, let's go rob a bank. You want to join me? You know, it doesn't sound like that. So that's, I think, the hard part, why our students sometimes are so conflicted, because it doesn't sound like that.
But if it does.
If it does, that works. But if it doesn't.
Plus, even in a corporate situation, now, you know, certainly if it's a criminal situation and you're dealing with police detectives who are questioning you, potentially trying to contaminate your memory, in a corporate setting you have the same thing. You know, oh no, that's not what we were talking about. We were talking about record that memory early on so that at least it's a recollection you can refer back to.
There's such an interesting technique or requirement in federal court that you sequester your witnesses. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also to the point, which is that you can't have a witness in a courtroom hearing what another witness has to say because of the contamination issue.
Look at all the discussion from your film. Yeah. Look at this.
I mean, the problem is that often things are contaminated without anyone realizing they're contaminated.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not just what you say, it's your body language, it's a million things. And when you have a traumatic crime, as you referred to earlier, there's other things that go on with the brain. We talked about this last time, like the weapon focus effect is just one example where, you know, if someone tells you they have a knife, you're focusing on that knife or where that knife may be, and other things kind of blur out. Mm-hmm. So it's what you're seeing in a situation as well.
Well, as I told last time we talked about this, I was in fact a witness at a murder trial. And maybe it's because of me, but nobody contaminated my recollection.
And that's what everyone thinks, right? Deborah, that's what everyone thinks. I have a great memory. I have a memory like, is it an elephant that we say?
Steel trap.
Steel trap. Elephants never forget.
Yeah.
That's right.
Just like, that's great that you said that.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many other studies that show, well, very common practice in a lot of law schools is the professor has something occur in the front of the class. You know, maybe somebody comes in and assaults somebody else or whatever, and not in real life, but, you know, and then the students are asked about it. And you get all these different stories and people focusing on different things. And then as they listen to the other stories, then their memories start changing, too. It's incredible what we human beings do.
It's true.
And there's a movie about it.
If I walked out of this room right now and asked each of you to describe me, I wonder what you'd say.
I would know, because my memory is never contaminated.
And mine's always contaminated. So, you know, somewhere there's a happy medium there. Yeah. Okay.
So what's next? So we can come. We can go to the film festival, see the film. Are you going to be there any of those days?
I will be there on the first evening, on the 17th, and then I'm going to Rome.
Ah.
Because I'm going to be showing the film at the University of Rome III in conjunction with the Italy Innocence Project.
Now, what's the Italy Innocence Project?
The Italy Innocence Project. Italy. It is an innocence project that's global, that's in Italy. looking
Hence
at,
the name.
Yeah, I mean, we have innocence projects all over the United States, and we have them in Europe as well. And I think they had Amanda Knox come back.
I was going to say, Amanda Knox is the...
she came back.
She came back,
to the Italy Innocence Project with her...
Now husband. Yeah. But...
I watched that documentary.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
It's really
painful.
Very.
Well, tell you what, let's take a short break here, real quick one, and we'll be right back.
Hi, everybody. It's David. I'm inviting you to join my wife, Karen, and me on a tour of Croatia and Slovenia in July. We'll see Dubrovnik, Split, and Zagreb. Travel along the majestic Adriatic coast. We'll explore the Roman ruins and the Renaissance palaces and leave plenty of time for you to take in the beauty on your own. Find more information at SteveBertrandTravel.com or call 847-606-6065.
Yeah. Kelly hates this music.
I mean, it's just...
yeah.
I don't want to hear...
It's Tuesday morning.
Hey, stop. 12:55. All of it. Stop.
Yeah. Okay, we're back. This is WGN Nightside, True Crime. And with the partners in crime, Professor Fraud, Bill Cressy of Governor State University, and...
I'm Kelly Pope.
Of Kelly Pope. Okay. So it's Pope Kelly and Professor Fraud here, and two in studio guests, including
Deb Tolchinsky
and
Mary Inman.
There you go. Okay, we did roll call. Everyone's here.
Yeah, clearly.
All right.
Right.
Okay. And we're talking whistleblowers. We're talking contaminated memories. Wow.
I have a question, Deborah. Were there any whistleblowers in any of the cases that you're following in your film?
You know, I know whistleblower is really hot right now. Everyone wants a whistleblower.
Everybody wants a whistleblower.
It is true. I keep hearing like, oh yeah, you get funding if you have a whistleblower.
Really?
Ah.
I know lots of whistleblowers. Hey, Mary?
It's a David and Goliath story. Every film, you know, every network wants that story, right?
Yeah, I suppose.
Speak truth to power.
But there's also reward money if you can walk through the minefield to get to it.
But Deborah, are there any whistleblowers?
I haven't thought of it in that way. I mean, what I've filmed so far. So I'm looking at the way memory and belief become hacked, basically, through three perspectives: an eyewitness who misidentifies, and that's what the short is about. A suspect who comes to believe they actually committed a crime that they didn't commit. And a detective who takes us through a false confession how that happened. And then I've also been filming with police in Arizona who are instituting new protocols that would radically reduce, I believe, these type of mistakes. And they're informed by HIG, or high-value detainee.
Wow. Wow. So maybe we can get the two of you together to work on a project about, you know, contaminated whistleblowers.
The three of us. Thank you very much.
Okay, the three of us. Okay. Well, the three of you. I'm just going to stay here behind
the
microphone.
Yeah, you're just the odd man out.
I'm the odd, obviously, yeah. in every sense of that word. But Mary, what are you doing next?
What am I doing next? So I have been given the daunting task of basically trying to educate the European and British public about the American whistleblower reward programs and actually persuading them in legislation in Parliament that they should consider our model in paying whistleblowers rewards basically for the career loss that they will suffer. It is a daunting task because British people culturally, when they hear the American accent, think, why, oh, you Americans, why is it that you need to be paid to do the right thing?
And you were over here, you missed the opening of Parliament and the Queen's Address and Boris Johnson and all those good folks.
I did miss the pomp and circumstance.
And
I just realized I do have a whistleblower.
Oh, you uh-huh. do?
There's always a whistleblower.
What have I been saying?
Yeah. So the detective that I've been filming with, he was seeing things going on that he thought was, it's not right. Do we have to break?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. We're going to have to bring you back you get back from Rome.
I'll just say really, really quick. So, and he came forward, and of course he was punished.
Okay. We got to go to news now. What a great True Crimes, and we'll see you next week. And let's go to news with Vic Vaughn.